Welcome back, everyone, to episode 3 of the Amateur Theatre Podcast. Hopefully you have enjoyed what I've put out so far. We've got a few more already recorded that I'm in the process of kind of pulling together and really looking forward to sending those out as well. If you're not subscribed, please do that. It'd be really great to begin to get an idea of who's actually listening. And if you haven't checked out the website yet, also head down there. Slowly but surely, I'm adding more and more resources and blogs linking to these interviews and other stuff that's kind of in my mind. That's at amateurtheatrepodcast.co.uk. We're also now on Twitter. I'm slowly getting around to Facebook, but there's been a lot of other stuff going on, so that's not quite there yet. As for today we are talking to Craig Finley. He's an actor that I've seen in a number of productions, but I've never actually had the privilege of working with him. Craig offers up some really great advice to amateur actors. We talk about understanding your character, how he develops his characters, his prep for auditions, how he works in rehearsals and how he hopes others work in rehearsals. We also discuss in a little bit more detail how he goes about creating his characters, amongst many other things. So sit back and enjoy. How's life?
All right, good, yeah.
Good, thanks for doing this. I guess if we can start by sort of getting, if you're happy to give like a rough idea of how you find yourself, where you are as an Oxford actor, like what was your trajectory through learning the craft? As a very like high level stuff, and then maybe we can dive in a little deeper on some of it.
Yeah, I've probably done a little bit of acting at school, been in school plays and stuff. I was quite a shy kid, actually, and it did sort of help with confidence building a bit. And I certainly wouldn't have had any, like, lead roles or anything until the sort of very end of school, like,
right,
when I sort of developed a bit of confidence and also sort of that understanding of the text sort of shone through as well. Like, you know, it helped that I'd sort of studied literature a bit and kind of got the hang of things. And also, like, got into Shakespeare films in my teenage years and got into it in quite a big way.
That's quite unique.
I know. I don't know how it happened. I saw Ken Branagh's Henry V when I was really young, like 10-ish. And I didn't understand a word, but I knew it was really cool. A, because it was like, you know, big battle sequences and, you know, that kind of appealed to me as a little boy. But also, I suppose maybe I'm sort of back projecting a little bit, but maybe something in the rhythm of the language.
Right.
You could hear something going on that was interesting, even if you didn't understand what they were actually saying. So I did watch that like quite a few times, you know, but between sort of age of 10 and, you know, and later in my teens, by the time I was 16, I could sort of get it, what they were saying.
Yeah.
And I was like, I really, really into this. So I did do my first Shakespeare play at school. It was The Tempest. And then
I'm going to interrupt straight away. I'm an interrupter. I'm really sorry. But given that you were like a shy kid, what was the impetus to get involved? So what was the driver to like find yourself actually going to your teacher or whatever and saying, yeah, I quite like to stand up there and embarrass myself? Because, and I say that because like I did a couple of things when I was younger and I only ever came off stage going, I've just embarrassed myself. Like, yeah. What was I thinking?
It certainly wasn't consciously going, oh, I need to build my confidence, or my parents saying that to me. I think it was just wanting to be involved in something.
Right.
And
okay.
As a kid, I was the kind of kid that wanted to do a bit of everything. Like, I wanted to be part of the sports teams. I wanted to do, you know, anything that was going on, I wanted to do it and wanted to sort of be involved in everything that there was going on. So I think, yeah, being in the school play was like a big deal. So you sort of join in with that. And at the time, I didn't really sort of expect a big role. It might have been nice. As will probably emerge in the interview, I do have this sort of ego thing. So maybe, you know, I was always hoping that people sort of recognize a bit of talent and right. you know, get a bit of praise out of that. So
that's a common theme.
But certainly to begin with, you know, I was getting very small parts, you know, even in the sort of musicals they did at school, I didn't really get even a speaking role sometimes. It was, you know, just being in the chorus.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. you got, in a way, that's a good apprenticeship, you know, learning how to react is not an easy thing. So maybe it did me some good.
Yeah.
Having to sort of learn how to react and not be the sort of center of attention all the time.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think I spoke to someone last week and he said that same thing. He said that was a, you know, and he also reiterated that I was asking him like little things that he thought were really key for actors. And one of them was just go back and watch some stuff and see the people that aren't talking and are having to just react, because you'll get a lot from like watching them and how they've chosen to like not have a center stage part, but still present as if they're fully like invested in what's going on.
Yeah, it's so important in any scene to keep the audience engaged. If you're on stage, you've got to be part of the story all the time. You can't, you know, for a second, you know, let the story drop away. You know, yeah, keep attention.
As in, you were just learning that as you were doing shows, but when do you think you became like present of that as a tool or resource? Was it just, did you just through osmosis realize that, or was it kind of like a, have you somewhere picked that up or been told that?
I don't know. You know, I think the realization of why it's important happened much later. That age in your teens was just, you kind of were told to, because it was sort of integral to the story. You know, you were given definitive things to react to, you know what I mean, that you have to say at a certain point.
Yeah, they're coming home, so look happy and clap kind of thing. And
yeah, that sort of stuff. Yeah. Or, you know, it was like Oliver or something, and a street urchin has just stolen something, so you look stern and
yeah.
stern, you know.
Yeah. So progressing on, you've gone through those years of just like school plays and stuff. Where did you push it through to, I mean, did you go off and follow it through A-levels and whatever? What was the...
I never studied it as a school subject. Yeah. So, I mean, my academic years it was sort of very strictly academic. You will do well in your exams. Right. You'll go to the university. That was like, you know, my trajectory. And it was always... The theatre is something you do extracurricular that makes you look well-rounded. But, you know, you're also allowed to enjoy it. I never studied it. But I was, you know, I was always around people who were as well. Oh, right. And sort of talked to them about their experiences. Because, you know, naturally some of the other people in the school play would have been students of drama, theatre studies, whatever. And... you know, the teachers as well, you know, you do sort of pick some things up, even if you're not in the lessons every day. It's just sort of interesting to draw out of them, you know, interesting things that they're covering, even if you're not sitting there taking exams in it, writing essays in it.
How have you interspersed those performances into your life, kind of from maybe the moment where the academic stuff took over? Have you just, as you said, just found the time and just done a show every few months or twice a year? What's kind of like been your approach to it?
Yeah, usually having finished university, I didn't do anything for a few years. I was in a band for a bit.
Oh, nice.
I'm in another band now. So I like, you know, I like performing. I like singing as well. After a while, I was like, oh, I want to get back into doing some shows on a regular basis.
Yeah,
and I had a look on the internet for local groups, and classically in Oxford, the first one you find is the Oxford Theatre Guild, and I went to watch the one that was coming up, and then auditioned for their next one, which was Antony and Cleopatra. So that would have been what, 11 years ago. I had a good time doing that, and it kind of starts rolling from there, because as soon as you've met that bunch of people in that cast, and whole production team and some people already came to see you in it.
Yeah.
And the members of that theatre scene. Then it, it sort of got the ball rolling then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, especially, well, I mean, I'm presuming maybe in other towns it's the same, but in Oxford, you can clearly see that once you're in with one, everyone's like, oh, new actor, hello.
Yeah.
What, where can we use this person? Can we steal them? What's you know, how's it going to work out? Yeah, it's very, I think people potentially feel like it might be difficult to get into a theatre scene, but actually, if you just stick your head up a little bit and make people aware that you exist, you're very quickly kind of enveloped into the arms of one team and then someone
exactly.
else. Yeah.
And the good thing, as open as it is, you know, that is the sort of best way in, really, because, you know, they have a policy of giving everyone a fair crack at auditioning for something.
Yeah, no, I just interviewed Simon. We went through that kind of the whole setup they've got, and obviously it feels, it's certainly much more open, if that's the word, than maybe something like mine is. But I, as much as I try and have open auditions, I'm also well aware that if I've got a couple of people that have done a few shows in the past, I'm like, I've got this part that you might like. Do you fancy coming in? Whereas, you know,
of course, and that's only natural, you know, if you know that they're going to produce the goods.
Yeah.
Then why not? Of course.
Yeah. What? Just kind of following through this thread. How come you've never pursued it as a? How come you've never seeked to be a professional? I suppose that's kind of the question I want to ask. Like, why have you chosen to continue in an amateur fashion?
It's a good question.
Because you're good enough, Craig. You're good enough.
Oh, thank you. I think there's a couple of aspects to it. One is sort of maybe sort of quite a sort of conservative with a small C mindset, like, I like having a 9-to-5 job. I do love what I do for a living, you know, being a librarian. I love working for the university. I love that side of my life. And acting is a very volatile profession, obviously. Actually, one of my brothers did try to make a career of it.
Really?
And he's sort of a useful sort of benchmark of how difficult and competitive it is.
Yeah.
And I think what he found is that just, you know, you the way that as a professional actor, you do have to be so relentlessly pushy to get yourself work. I think that didn't come naturally to him, however talented he is. And also, like we were just saying, I can be a bit more picky about what I choose to take on, you know. So you can do things that are fulfilling, you know, there have been years where I've done sort of maybe up to 4 shows in a year. There are the years when I've only done 1, maybe not any at all.
Right.
Yeah, it just depends on the circumstances, really. And much like at school, what's going on with work? And just, you know, how interesting the project is, you know, how much it takes my fancy, as it were, to get involved in that particular thing. A lot of it's who else is involved, or is it a play I've always liked and been interested in, wanted to do? Does somebody approach me and say, oh, well, I think there'd be a good part in this for you, sort of thing?
That's always the best one, right?
Yeah. But then, I don't know, as we'll come on to, you've got to learn to say no as well. Sometimes you go, sometimes, you know, the time's just not right, or, you know, you get asked because they're short of certain people in a certain age range, that kind of thing. So it's not always the right thing. And you know, you don't want to go into a project that you're not really motivated to do because you're doing a bad job.
I think that's definitely something I want to come on to, because again, it's an interesting thing for an actor. Motivation being one big one, but also like, if you're just not getting it, if you're not feeling it, how do you deal with that? So I guess if we can circle back around to that, that'd be great. I've always like had this thing where if you want to do the best work you possibly can, the best place to be is surrounded by people who have the resources to do their best work as well, if that makes sense. And I wonder what you're feeling on in terms of like how you approach that from an amateur perspective, what you might get in costumes or staging or kind of just even a venue might not be where you kind of have pictured this play going. What's your kind of feeling on dealing with that? Because it just feels like you within yourself could create the best character and do your best performance, and yet the shaping of the play will diminish what you can deliver, if that makes sense.
Yes, that's a good point. I mean, I guess I would argue that, yeah, I've been lucky sometimes to be in companies where you kind of, yeah, you might have some people who are inexperienced or, you might feel a sort of struggling a bit with their level of performance, but I think it becomes a team effort, doesn't it? And you can bring those people with you. They really, really grow into, they may not end up turning out sort of spectacular Oscar winning performance, but you really can lift them right up their level of performance.
I may be taking asking that question, the negative view of it, in that those elements that you miss out on in a professional production drag you down. But actually, there are other elements that, as a group, you can bring together to bring it all up that will kind of supersede any sort of little issues that you might be missing out on, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, yeah, in a way, like you say, it's inevitable. But likewise, the professional theatre, there's a sort of a range of resource levels within the professional theatre itself. You have some very well-funded, well-established places where you are kind of, you go to Stratford, you're probably guaranteed a decent level of performance. But sometimes you'll have smaller companies who are on a tight budget and, they don't necessarily have the big resources. And I suppose, economically speaking, amateur shows don't have to pay their actors, so they have a little bit of finance that they can use elsewhere. I mean, that probably makes not a whole lot of difference. I know creatively, it does make a difference, actually, in some cases, because you notice with a lot of professional touring companies, they cut down on numbers. You see a lot of shows done with three actors, there's no way, very few professional companies can afford a cast of thousands.
I agree with that. I think it might have been slightly a loaded question. I know you can definitely have like amateur shows that are amazing and, even when the Globe goes out, they don't take
full ensemble of people all the time.
Yeah.
Although I just went to watch Tom Stoppard's Leopoldstadt, and he deliberately
had 10,000 people.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's loads of kids, and yeah.
I know. I saw the cast photo. I was like, "Fuck you now." What's your kind of? How do you handle expectations from like audience members coming to an amateur show? Because from a director's point of view, I've watched some of my shows and gone, "Oh shit." Why did I do that in that scene? I hate it so much. There's no time to change it. What have I done? And my gut is just watching the audience going, oh, you guys are not enjoying it. And then I look at my actors and I'm like, I'm so sorry, guys. I've made you do that in that way. Oh, this is not right. I'm just wondering whether you've come across that and how you deal with it and what your kind of thoughts on expectations of people coming to see amateur theatre.
I think you probably know when you're onto a good one. No, they're going to love it. When you don't feel like that, yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm probably a little bit less enthusiastic about telling quite as many people about it. But I suppose there's one thing, I might get in trouble for, but I always see that as my role. I'm not publicity.
Right.
It's not my job to bring people. My job is to perform to the people who come. So I don't see myself have to market it, but I see what you mean. Like, some people will come with certain expectations.
They might be slightly diminished. If you're paying £17.50 a ticket versus £60 a ticket, maybe your expectations are slightly different. You know, you maybe there's a slightly a larger grace a space for kind of
maybe
giving
the actors. But yeah, £17.50 for a night's entertainment, it's still a fair whack. You know, you want to be entertained for that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and I've been in one or two where I felt, you know, we haven't given people value for money here, and I don't like that feeling at all.
Right.
No.
And what, not obviously not to name names or shows or whatever, but what kind of how have you dealt with it? Like, what have you done? Are you just doing the best performance you can, or are you coming off and going, look, guys, we should be doing this? Or is there how have you kind of approached?
Yeah, I think it's probably the format, especially, I mean, if you knew the production team really well, then maybe I would have felt confident enough to say something. But if you don't, then yes, it is just a case of, look, I'm just going to try and wow people with,
yeah,
pour everything, what I can into it. Just, you know, and I don't have any control over the quality of the set or the costumes or the music or the overall visitor experience. You know, are people getting served drinks at the interval, that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Which actually, you know, because I have friends who aren't, you know, they're not actors themselves, you know, just people from work or whatever, that they'll comment on things like that.
They really?
Want to tell how good
that's
you
interesting.
Were. They'll say, oh, it was really cold, there were no blankets or stuff like that.
You know? That's interesting. It's weird stuff like that. Like, again, my focus on these conversations have been like around
the creative process. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, those little superfluous things are really important because, yeah, if you're shivering your ass off, it really doesn't matter how good the show is. The two old grannies are going to stand up and walk out of the interval because they just can't handle it. They're just like, you know, as much as they might be liking what they're seeing, you know, they don't want to be dead by the end.
And, in rehearsal, like I said before, you know, be as generous as you can with the other actors. You know, give them the chance to practice. Well, talking about this sort of professional amateur thing, I think what I really respect is sort of professional values in other people. It's sort of
right.
Respect for each other, turn up on time, learn your
words.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
You know, have just respect for your colleagues.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's also just stuff that's not like. You don't have to have gone to drama school to learn that.
No.
You have to work with Kenneth Branagh to know that turning up on time is like quite important. It's fucking annoying when they don't. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm famously one of Oxford's most punctual actors.
Are you? Outstanding.
But he's certainly on time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's really weird that you say, because from a director's point of view, my own experience is the challenge I've always faced is, like, I'm happy to assist someone who I feel like I can talk through a role or like a scene or whatever. And I know that's what directors should be doing, but like, I'm not scared of any of the actors I've worked with to the point where I won't say, look, I didn't like that. Let's have a look at it. I'm not going to let them just do their thing and drift off into whatever. But I do have a big problem, and this might be just a personal thing, but it might be something I might dive into with someone else, but as a director, telling people off that I'm not paying, I find really difficult.
Mm.
Even for being late, and what you just said is probably, you know, just listening now, it's probably the best approach. Like, have respect for everyone else because fuck, don't worry about me. But you've made Timmy and Jane wait for 20 minutes because you're doing their scenes with them first. Because I always have this thing in the back of my head that's like, well, you guys are giving me your time and you guys are, you know, and I know it's difficult with the buses, isn't it? And like everyone else made it here, but you didn't. But it's like, I don't know, it's weird.
You have a disproportion of what's going on in everybody's life though as well, you know. Some will have more commitments than others.
Yeah.
I guess you just got to be kind of, I suppose some theatre companies do make it explicit, like the Oxford Theatre Guild would make you sign something to say, you know, I'll do these basic things or I'll lose the part in the show, you know.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know what would be a good, whether we want to use a specific example or just maybe just generically about any play that you look at. What's kind of your first, what triggers your imagination? What gets you to potentially be thinking about turning up to that advert that you saw on Facebook or wherever it is, what's the initial impetus to sort of dive in?
And often it is a piece of writing that I'm either familiar with from having seen before or aware of because it's well known. Or, you know, I'd listen to somebody recommended something if I hadn't heard of it and have a read. You know, I do like to read the full play before I go.
Really?
Yeah, if I can. Or at least have a glance over it.
Yeah.
Just to see whether you'd be interested. I think there's one came up recently, actually, which I did audition for. But once I read the play in full, it put me off. I was like, I don't actually like this that much. Or, you know, I wouldn't feel motivated to do this right now.
Right.
You know, it's quite a sort of harrowing story. And I sort of didn't feel in the mood for that this year.
Yeah.
So, whereas sometimes, you know, it's different. Yeah, it's different because like a Shakespearean tragedy, you know, can be cathartic and all that. So often it's the play itself, usually.
Right.
I think. Or, you know, like we just said, it's the people you know being back together in a group again. And that is like a huge incentive there because, you know, they're your friends, they're your team.
You want to be part of that experience that they're about to create again, yeah?
Yeah, and familiarity is a huge bonus, actually. You work so smoothly with people you know. You're so much more relaxed. That makes such a difference. I can't emphasize enough how much self-consciousness is the sort of the enemy of an actor.
Right.
And being in that team, that familiar space again. I mean, I'm a pretty confident person now anyway, but I think it really helps for people who are less confident, you know, that they can just be comfortable with people they know because they are more self-conscious in front of people they are unfamiliar with.
Yeah. No, you can see it. Over the last kind of 5 years of doing the Shakespeare stuff, you can see when you get those bigger casts together that there's always, you know, four or five people who are the newbies who are tiptoeing around. They're not really sure. And then you get the guys that have been there for 5 years all high-fiving and like making lots of noise. You're like, okay, should we try and integrate the new people into the show a little bit, you know? And we're reminiscing about last year and stuff.
That's where it can backfire, I suppose, where it gets a bit cliquey.
Yeah.
You do need to be careful of that. Because that will be to the detriment of your show if some people are deeply self-conscious and some people aren't.
I suppose that's a good point for an amateur director, just to be aware that if you are building that team together but you're still bringing newbies in, just be conscious of the fact that they will be very self-conscious. They're very aware that they're going into a room. And I've noticed it even in like auditions when my guys, when I say you guys are going to audition again, just because, and the guys that I've had before will come all together and they'll be in the room ready to audition, chatting, catching up. Mm. And the people who are there also to audition are like, what is going on? There's six people here who are definitely getting parts. There's no way I'm getting a part. They all know each other. So yeah, that can be difficult as well. I think I've learned.
It's true then what you said before about it feeling difficult to break into. Yes, it can feel like a really intimidating in that first ever audition you do.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That one where you finally got the courage up to just turn up. I'm going today. I'm definitely going to this one. Yeah. You turn up and then it's like, fuck, what have I done?
Yeah.
And then you do the audition and the director's an asshole. You're like, what have I done? Yeah. Okay. And so you're reading the play. Are you picking a specific character? Are you reading it and going, I love Macbeth, maybe I shouldn't use that as an apple. Maybe are you picking the character that feels most you're most in tune with, or are you looking for the one with the most lines, the most work? And I'm not trying to paint you or anyone else as like wanting to be the lead all the time, but like I would presume that taking the lead is a great thing to do.
Oftentimes, yeah. Sometimes, yeah, I wanted to play the lead just because my own ambitions, and you know, we mentioned ego once, and that is important. You know, I do it because I want people to, I want to receive praise and be noticed and have attention. I do like those things. You know, I won't deny it.
Yeah, but that isn't, yeah, it is going to be in response to hard work and good work. Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but from what, from the shows I've seen you in, like, you're not just phoning it in. So it's not like, give me praise, I'm on stage. It's kind of like a, see the work I'm doing.
Yeah, because it's an opportunity to show what you can do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But this, I mean, like, I played Fest Day this, of course, and I that's the part, having watched Twelfth Night, the movie, I'm thinking, oh, that's the part I think I'd enjoy most, actually.
Right.
I mean, there's not really a male lead in that as such, so you kind of choose between it. I'd say probably Malvalio has the most lines. And I was responsible for the cut, and I cut quite a lot of Feste's own words. But
oh, really?
But I think it's fine. Interesting this summer, but the way he ended up being was not how I'd envisioned it actually when I went in at all.
Oh, right, okay.
Because I wanted to be like Ben Kingsley, who's kind of quite understated, a bit sort of melancholic kind of fool. He's often played that way. But we realized that would not work in 2021. You want something lively, upbeat, cheer people up. And it's interesting, the part can be played completely opposite ways like that.
Is it to your detriment if you do go in saying, I want to be Macbeth, and they message you and say, Macduff, and you're like, what?
I don't know. You might have a sort of disappointment for a time, but I think it's important to sort of reflect, well, actually, is that a pretty good part in itself?
And
will I enjoy being part of this production anyway?
Yeah.
Sometimes you've got your heart absolutely set on a part and you don't get it, and it's like, oh, well, I'm not sure I could bear it to be involved.
Watching someone else do the work that I could be doing,
but sometimes, you know, I'm not that bothered, you know, I leave it up to the director, you know, I'll do what you want me to do in this particular play, because any of these parts could be good. And I think, having only read it once, maybe you've only got a really superficial understanding at that point. And you know, it's not until you start rehearsing it for real that you start to get that sense of that character belonging to you a bit more.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. No, I think I kind of say it because I've seen a few actors who you can clearly see they want a specific part, and they'll deliver the monologue of that character. And the responses to emails when you say, look, I really like you, but this is where I see you fitting in this production. The responses you can see are like, yeah, but I'm really good for Macbeth, right? Like, yeah, I know, but not this time. I just feel like I get the impression that people who I've auditioned are missing out on some good stuff because they fixed their mind on, you know, taking on a specific role. And they may not see that because, as you say, they may be like, well, this time around, I'm in the mood for doing this and I would like to play it, but I don't think I could handle playing that other part you've offered me. Fine. So I guess it's just a balancing act within themselves. I just, from a director's point of view, I feel if someone comes in saying, I want to be Macbeth, and they've emailed like 5 minutes before saying, I'm great in this part, see you in half an hour, you're going to love this audition. Like, yeah, okay. I don't know if I am, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's just like...
But that can be sometimes be the advantage of just the method of picking and choosing who you want. Like, you are, you know, I'm going to phone up such and such and he's going to play this part and he doesn't get a choice.
Yeah, that's true.
But also, yeah, I mean, from the director's point of view, of course, you might see something that you've not noticed before. When you try different ways around, you know. I had an audition for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern years ago, and you know, the it ended up being the really not the obvious combination at all.
Right.
As two leads, because they in the auditions they tried it every possible combination. And then something just clicked between two.
Right.
And that's the way it ended up. You know, everybody that came to the audition obviously wanted those roles because they were the big parts.
Of course.
Apart from me, who wanted to play Hamlet just to say he's played. But in the wrong show.
Yeah, no one has to know that, right? Okay, so and in terms of an audition prep for yourself, what's your process in getting ready? Are you prepping a set monologue and beating the shit out of it at home until you know you've got it perfect, or are you leaving it a little bit loose, or are you, you know, what are all the like the little things that you're kind of taking into account before you get in the room?
Yeah, it does depend what they've asked you to do, really. I think if they have asked you to learn something, then yeah, make sure you know it. But be prepared for curveballs as well. You know what I mean? Is that you've learned the speech a certain way, and then they say, "Oh, well, do it." You know, do it really sarcastically, and then you've learned it that one way, and you can't.
Yeah, can't adapt.
Can't divert from that in the moment. So I guess you've got to be prepared for that. But I don't think many amateur directors will make your life that difficult.
No.
And in fact, not my experience of auditions is not being worked hard enough, I think.
Really?
Yeah, people don't... I don't know. I think...
In the shows that you have auditioned for, do you normally just go in and they say, can you deliver something for us? Whether they've sent it to you or said, like, pick a monologue from whatever... Or how are they normally set up? Are you doing kind of like group stuff, or is it just a mixed bag again?
Yeah, usually it's sort of do an individual piece, just to show what you do, and then they'll pair you up or put you in a three to prepare a scene together, and maybe, you know, alternate the parts. Or I think it's a good idea in auditions to there's a sort of classic technique of, well, can you respond to direction? Can you do this a completely different way? And if they do it the exact same way, then you can tell that they're going to struggle with direction. But sometimes that is a bit unfair, maybe, because...
It's such a difficult environment.
Yeah, and the real rehearsal process isn't like that. You're refining something. You're not...
Yeah, definitely.
...performing it every time. You know, it's subtle changes. And so maybe that is a bit artificial. How, you know, very versatile an actor can be, and maybe that's not what you're looking for.
Yeah. So let's say you've been given a monologue, what's your kind of approach to that? How are you like digesting it and interpreting it and then kind of creating it for the person you're about to stand in front of, or the people you're going to stand in front of? Is there a specific way you go about it, or are you...
No, I mean, it's much like performing it for real, really. It's, you know, you just got to direct yourself, you know, think in detail about where to put the intonation in the lines to make it interesting, because you do have to grab someone's attention.
Yeah.
You know, more so than in performance, where that might be seen as, you know, overacting a little bit, but. I keep going back to this first audition for the Guild, but I did this speech from Coriolanus, and I chose that because I thought it would stand out more because it was rare and not done very often. And if I could do it well, then they would notice me and they would say, right, this guy knows the stuff he can do. He can speak verse. He can do Shakespeare. And that seemed to have worked.
And you've used it ever since. I like it. Are you saying that's advisable as a trick to pick something that's not to be or not to be, or is not, like, you know,
probably, yeah, but it's like being a job interview. They say, you know, I mean, without embarrassing yourself, do you know, have something memorable about you, so that if they're auditioning 20 people, you will stick out.
Yeah.
it's rare that I've been in that situation in Oxford. You know, there's only that one first time when nobody knows who you are.
Yeah, true.
I mean, I suppose I've auditioned for directors that haven't seen me before. But in those cases, yeah, you probably do want to just do something that will make it a bit more memorable, yeah.
And would you prescribe a Shakespeare monologue, or are you pitching it based on what you're auditioning for? Because I've had people say, like, Shakespeare, generally, you can rely on that. If you've got a good Shakespeare monologue under your belt, it's a good fallback. And then if you're specifically want to show them something, you can find something else. Or is it?
I think you'd rarely be given total free rein, you know. Okay. If you're auditioning for a Shakespeare play, they want to hear you do that.
Yeah.
If you're auditioning for a modern piece, they want to hear
some of those.
They'll either give you a piece from the play itself or something contemporaneous. So it won't be given total free rein to just, well, here's my repertoire. Because,
Okay, and in the room, I'm going to picture my audition room, chair, three people, two people sat in front of you. What's kind of your advice for getting into that room? And I will give you the worst auditions that I see are people who come in, sit down, pick up the piece of paper, read it, say thanks very much. And I'm like, hold on a second, how about you keep it a chair over there, maybe do it standing up. And then they stand up, hold it in front of them and read it. I'm like, okay, cool. And then it's a challenge to try and then tease, especially if you see there might be something, you're teasing it out. But have you got kind of any, what would be your approach? Are you going in and trying to blast them away, or are you going in like just?
I don't put too much pressure on myself for a start. Okay. You know, nice. I have conquered nerves a long time ago. I have some confidence in my own ability, so I don't get too nervous. But yeah, like we said before, the more you do it, the more relaxed you are. If you're familiar with the people, you'll be relaxed. And don't put too much stress on the result. You know, yeah, you won that part, but you know, is it the end of the world if you don't get it?
Mm-hmm.
So that helps sort of keep you relaxed, and probably you'll end up giving a better audition as a result of it. And be open to what they say as well. You know, be ready for the suggestions, the curveballs, and so on, which won't always happen.
Yeah, but when they do, sometimes
there is no curveball.
No, I've given curveballs of, here, take this. Can you come back and do it, as you say, in more sarcastic or something? If that, I've said a couple of times, if that is the advice, if that's the direction you're given, at least try and do that bit of direction. Mm-hmm. At least change it slightly. You know, come back in and don't.
But the difficulty is, some people, like, I'm quite good at sight reading, and some people just aren't at all.
Yeah, it's just, I know.
I'm sort of lucky in that respect. And again, it's sort of, I feel like it gives me a bit of an edge in those scenarios that, you know, that's a strength of mine and other people it isn't.
no, definitely. No, I mean, I think, and as you say, if you also have conquered some element of your nerves, then any additional stuff you're being asked to do, your brain is not foggy. You know, you're ready to kind of adapt and respond. Someone who's already shitting their pants and then gets told to dance a jig while they do it, they're like, oh my God, what is going on here? Why did I come to this decision? Yeah. Okay, cool. Right, let's say you've been cast in the show, right? And you're now about to hit kind of read through rehearsal stuff. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Are you kind of off book at all? What have you done with the script prior to kind of, are you doing any work prior to going to a read through or the first rehearsal?
It's good to start getting familiar, even if you're not off book. I mean, I find it helps to do it in the space once with it. And then just in case, because the opposite is that you learn it one way and then you can't
unlearn it.
Move from that. You get frozen in the way you've learned it, and then that's
just
So I would say learn, do it in the rehearsal room once with the book in your hand.
Yeah.
And then learn it. And then the sooner you can learn it after that point, the better to get. And by learn it, I mean learn it inside out. You can do it backwards. Because, and I don't always do that, but I think that would be the ideal. Because once you know it so well that you can just rattle it off, then you can do anything with the line. Then you can play around with it any way you like, because it's all just loaded in your mouth without your brain having to do anything. And then your brain can think about, well, I can adjust this word and shift the intonation pattern around and so on. So yeah, I know I do work with directors who say be off book day one. I think my preference is early, but not day one.
No, I think it's different. I found it really difficult. Like you can say be off book by this date, but you end up, you know, especially like newbies or whatever, like it's so difficult with, you know, what's going on with life and stuff. And, you know, you do find that you're a month in, there's still someone with a script in their hand. You're like, you know, we were off book last week, mate. And you're like, oh, I know, but I have no idea what I'm saying. I could stand there during the rehearsal and just, you know, ask for cue lines the whole time, but it's not going to help me at all. So but
it's good to know who, you know, if, it's good to admit to yourself, if you're a person who struggles with lines, then put that extra work in if you're the person that struggles with lines.
Yeah. That's a good advice generally. Like highlight those areas where you know that you've got, you know, specific, not failings, specifics, or you struggle more in those areas.
Mm.
Because that will, as you say, if you're left behind, you're reliant on people to bring you back into the fold and make sure you have.
Yeah. And it's so disruptive though. If everybody's in full flow and it's, you know, just dries up and is forgotten. But I think it works is that, you know, when to help those people along, just feed it to them line by line, even if they're like.
Oh, to make them say it, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically like a wedding service, repeat after me. Yeah. Just to keep the flow going rather than sort of every 20 seconds, just, oh, we've dropped again, you know.
And it embarrasses them a little bit as well, which is nice. So they suddenly realize that someone's feeding them the lines the whole time. Like, maybe next week I'll learn some more. Okay. And how do you like in those first moments of like week? And again, just to set the scene a bit, I'm shaping this around like we're not talking 3 weeks of rehearsals every day, whatever. We're talking amateur theatre 3 months. So we're doing, you know, we'll do a read through at some point and then we'll hit rehearsals where we're doing three a week, let's say, of an evening for a couple of hours. How do you like those first few weeks to go? Do you want the director to have mapped out the blocking of each of the scenes? Do you like it to be a bit more organic? How would you prefer the rehearsal space to be in those first sort of moments, given that you're all kind of learning who your characters are and stuff?
I guess my personal preference is the structured way, like some sort of definitive, this person's standing here, this person's standing here sort of idea, like you've got a sort of shape of how it looks. But always with an idea that could change further down the line.
Right.
Totally free form and organic doesn't work so well for me, but you know, I will do it. You know, I'll do my best, but it helps to have a starting point to work with it. And I think this is true of the sort of, this is one thing I learned from my brother actually, is that, it's important to make definitive choices. And the problem with free form organic is that often ends up being quite vague and not defined enough. The end result is too freeform.
Right.
Whereas when I'm a director, I'm like an American football coach. I've got X's and O's and arrows pointing where
Really?
Yeah. I'm quite dictatorial as a director. Because I've got a vision of the shape of what it's, you know, sight lines and everything. And
No, I
take a chalkboard in and
right, everyone, sit down. We're going to run through. It's weird because I would say I'm much more, and to my, definitely to my detriment, because the thing you just said just rung real true. Is like making those definitive choices. I'm very conscious that I need to make them, but I do like to see where it meanders. Mm. The problem I've always had is once you start meandering, as you say, you still have to make those choices. Those choices still have to be made at some point, because if you don't make those choices, then it meanders into the shows and you're like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
So yeah, the balance for me is definitely allowing the actors to feel they've got a bit of like freedom to do what they want and go where they want, but also kind of in my head know that ultimately I see this picture. If they're moving towards it, I'll leave them. If they're not, I'll try and nudge them into it. And it's much harder. I say much harder. I feel like it might be much harder. If you go in and you say, look, guys, here is the template. Look, you move there, you move there, blah, blah, blah. Now let's act. I guess that might be a slightly.
Well, this is something, as an actor, I have worked on over time, because like it was pointed out to me and it was astute of the director to do it, is that, you know, my sort of vocalized work was quite well developed, but my movement was not at all. Like I would shuffle quite hesitantly. Movements weren't very well defined. And so I did have to think about that. You know, and making movements more definitive.
Right.
And, you know.
And it was the director tying that into specific, like, specifically to like what you're saying and when you're saying it, or was it just an overview of like your characterization was like that? What?
Both, really. Yeah. I mean, certainly the two instances I'm thinking of were, it just wasn't right for either of those characters at all. You know, one was a politician, very sure of himself, barking orders at people. His movement would have been
clinical.
Direct,
yeah,
clinical, clear-headed. And the other one, I was playing Oberon, so he was sort of quite bold in his movement. I mean, yeah, Al kept saying to me, oh, think Freddie Mercury, be extravagant, be like big, bold movements. And, you know, I was playing within myself quite a lot.
Right.
You know, like I said, at that stage, I was a bit more self-conscious than I am now.
Right.
So I had to, that is something I did work on over time. And I think last few years I've got much, much better at that than in the sort of earlier days.
And is that just, sorry, go on.
Well, you're thinking as a director then, you'll have actors in that position, especially early in the rehearsal process.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
They'll be really hesitant about what they want to try.
Yeah, and definitely.
I suppose it's sort of getting them to like, oh, I see where you're going with that. Do that to the extreme. Let's see if it works. If it doesn't work, let's do something different, but also do that.
Yeah, 100%.
Don't, because otherwise you'd be doing something at 5% that an audience would just not pick up on at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's really weird. There's two things like, so it's so clear that that's the way it should be done. So difficult. I'm not an actor, but it's so difficult for an actor to do that. And like, you're right. If you take it to 100, you can bring it back down. Like if you start at 2, so hard to get it up to 50 and then from 50 to where it needs to be. But
then sometimes I've heard a director say, oh, can you do it bigger? And the actor says, I thought I was. And by bigger, I mean 100 times, not 10 times.
Yeah, definitely. It's so great. And then, but as you said, quite rightly, like the two come together. The confidence is one. But the confidence is shaped around being in a space that you feel confident in.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the idea that those first few weeks, if you can create a space where everyone's like happy and willing to like, I don't know what whether it's make mistakes or look silly or what it is, but they feel like there's a safety and security when they walk in that room that they can, you know, just get it wrong.
Yeah. And I see it all the time. I just think to myself, you know, you are of other actors, like you are so good. There's no need for you to be subconscious.
Yeah.
I was. So, you know, go ahead, you know, make mistakes, or, you know, I won't even regard it as a mistake. Just do it the way you want to do it. We'll see.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when you know they're a good actor, it's like, so important to find them, let them kind of loose. Crazy. How are you then? Let's say you've got that space, and you know, as you just said, like maybe you like it to be it. You like to know the outline shape of the blocking and stuff, and I presume that falls in line with like the image and the concept of the play as well. You like you mm-hmm. kind of want to know yeah. where we're going, what we're doing. How then are you shaping your character yourself? Like, how are you, if you've got those frameworks in place, what's your kind of approach to seeing where your individual character will end up? And I've, you know, is it bouncing off the other characters? Is it getting deep into the words of the play? Is it what's the?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, yeah, first stage really is think about the dialogue, think what you're saying, and are you saying it in a way that sounds authentic and rings true?
Okay.
I'm probably getting a bit sort of skewed towards the Shakespeare here, but you know, there are ways of delivering Shakespeare that it's sort of either it sounds sort of slightly grating because the meaning's not quite coming out in the way you're intoning the words because you don't really understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
Or it sounds a bit, we're probably diverting, but, or it can sound a bit boring because I think there's this sort of, the way we learn poetry in this country as a nation is sort of, we have this sort of ingrained rhythm in our heads that goes da-dum, 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 da-dum. And that's really dull to listen to over and over again. So you've got to find ways in the verse that bring it to life.
Right.
You know, and I mean, we're just to focus on the Shakespeare for a second. One technique that a lot of people do now is that you look up the sort of No Fear Shakespeare modern English translation. You see what it means, like what you're saying, work out where the stress patterns would fall in the modern English, translate that back into the blank verse, and then magically you're suddenly bringing it to life.
Yeah, it's nice.
But I think you're right as well. I think the more times you do the scene with the other actors, you find so much there, and then the relationships between the characters is obviously what's going to drive the drama a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I'm not a big one for sort of motivations and, you know, super objective.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Okay.
Probably because I think I worry I would get distracted by them if I'm Morris. You know what I mean?
So how are you? Okay. That's interesting. So how are you like?
I think I probably want to be as in the moment as I can be.
Okay, cool.
So as the character, I suppose it's always got to be there, what the character's motivations are. But I think, yeah, certainly reacting to what's immediately happening around you.
Okay.
I'm saying these words because the character wants to say them, has a reason to say them at that specific moment in time.
Okay, so are you just looking specifically at a scene then? How, you know, you're looking at what is the dynamic of this scene? What does my character want out of this scene? Rather than saying he's motivated to be king and therefore in this moment he will be doing this.
Yeah, that probably is my process. But I wonder if some very astute observers might occasionally pick up on some inconsistencies
okay.
in my performance.
Oh, you mean across your... Oh, really?
I think some people have said sometimes, you know, you have to watch pretty closely because it's not normally that bad. But that is the risk, I suppose, you run.
Yeah.
In doing it that way is that, yeah, you might lose the overall thread.
Yeah.
From scene to scene. So if I go off stage for 20 minutes, do I come back on as a sort of consistent with the character I went off as?
Because
if I go off stage and do a crossword, have a cup of tea, Daniel Lewis. I don't stay in character backstage. I don't know. I think that is just, it kind of works for me that way. I think the power of concentration you need to maintain it is just massive. Like to keep it consistent. I mean, I'm doing my best.
No, I mean, I'm clearly not one of the astute people because it's not something that I've picked up on. But it's interesting. Because you could do it, right? You could use that as a kind of a foundation of the character, and you could have that in your head as you weave your way through the play. What do you feel like you're gaining by doing it? I don't want to say scene by scene, but however, whatever your kind of like in the moment approach is, because from my perspective, I'm gonna put words in your mouth, and please just tell me I'm wrong. But it feels like it's quite nice an approach, because as you enter a scene, you could be saying to yourself, right. Okay, so this scene, I'm coming to speak to this person and I want to talk about marriage. And then someone walks in and says, your son's dead. And you're like, you're responding then to that rather than thinking about, oh, the whole play, I'm trying to get here. I know I want to end up at this spot, whatever. You actually got that momentary, like those peaks and troughs come in response to like, she said that. And then this guy came in and told me my son was just been shot. And you're like, would that be where the benefit comes from it, or am I just kind of making stuff up?
I think so. No, I think you're right. I suppose different actors work differently. This is sort of a ground up approach. It's like I look at the individual pieces, mm-hmm. how it all stacks together,
right?
Rather than working down from the top, and sort of my motivation will sort of drip down into all the individual pieces.
Right, I see.
So I guess that is
You reach the same point then, basically, is what you're saying. I think
you should if you do a good job, yes.
Okay, cool. I would say, and again, it would be interesting when we jump into a quick discussion about like knowledge training, drama school stuff, it would be interesting to see what your thoughts on that are in terms of like, I would say I'm making this up, but the majority of people have the top trickle down approach.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that is kind of like a standard. What is your character's motivation? How is that influencing his or her kind of moment by moment interactions?
Yeah. And I wouldn't say I don't think about that at all.
No, of course.
My sort of standard way of operating is to sort of
have that as the, I mean, you can't not. If you've read the play and you know what happens in the end, you can't not be aware of the fact that he's about to die or whatever it is. Yeah. Okay. So, and then now if we're like really getting into the meat of the rehearsals, let's just say like we're off book and we're whatever. How is your characterization coming out? Like what are you doing to kind of build up a realistic person who's about to go onto stage? Are you looking at their backstory and creating a lovely backstory about how, you know, when he was 15, he fell off his bike and busted his finger, and that's why, you know, can't hold a sword properly, and this is why he's going to, well, you know, that's a silly example, but you know what I mean? Like, are you constructing that sort of stuff in the background, or?
I think, like, we go back to this process of refinement. Obviously, listening to the director, if the director wants to change something, then, like, listen to what they're saying and, you know, work on that until they think you've got it right. But if it was just a case of directors not really telling you to do anything, you just want to improve it for yourself, I think there's real value in, weirdly, being outside the rehearsal room, letting it sort of percolate in your head, reflecting on it.
Right.
And then things will come to you. Like, oh, I've been saying that line all wrong all this time. Okay. Or, I could put... like as a comedy character, I could put an extra little J gesture or joke and see what happens next time, see if they like it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, oh, why am I facing that direction? Yeah, so things like that would just sort of occur to me, you know, eating breakfast or something.
Okay. No, but they sound like they're the more...
I'll try that this evening. I'll do it that way.
Yeah. But they sound like they are the more kind of like idiosyncratic things. You know, you're creating, which is obviously really, really interesting, which is, you know, it's important that people who are creating those characters are aware that your character may walk in a specific way. You should be thinking that, does he walk, you know, is he walking with a limp or does he walk with authority? As you said about the, you know, the politician, an interesting directorial kind of note was, look, he's walking in a clinical way, or that's the word I use, but, you know, he's kind of, that's something that you should be looking into. What about the bigger, I don't know what the word is. I'm desperately trying not to use the word motivations because we just discussed that you're not. Yeah. But like, I feel like in order to create that rounded character, is there a necessity to have something kind of deeper, or do you kind of feel like it's not all that necessary? And I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just interested to sort of hear what your thoughts on it are.
There is, but in that, there's an assumption that the writer has done their job perfectly.
Okay.
You know, they've written a consistent character throughout. And if they haven't, you kind of have to fix it.
Yeah.
So there is, it is consistent. But if the writer's done a good job, your life is easy. You deliver what they've written as it's written.
Yeah.
That will happen naturally. I think, yeah, like I was saying about the sort of being in the moment, I do like to sort of, now we can start talking sort of the real pretentious side of character development.
Good, let's do it.
It's not pretend, it's be the person, you know, feel what that person is feeling.
Okay.
So if you, so imagine, it's not all external. It's like, imagine you feel sort of this sort of crushing sensation of grief or something. So I like tense up the inside of my stomach, which nobody would be able to see. But it's like, oh, that's what that feeling feels like. And it will translate to your outside.
Okay.
You know, it will be sort of perceptible.
Okay, so you're kind of manifesting muscle memory responses that you know that you would feel.
Yeah.
And that then reflects outwardly. I've never noticed you tensing your stomach, but I have noticed that, you know, there's been some angst in some of your characters. Yeah. So
much better abs after
my yeah. Okay, cool. Okay. That's a really good trick as well for people. If they can begin to remember what it felt like when they last cried, what were the physical manifestations of that? Then maybe replicating those things, you know, if you're someone who does this the whole time when they're crying, maybe that your body will begin to think, oh, this is a response I would give if I was crying. And this is, yeah. Okay. That's nice. And so just continue on that kind of thread of, you know, I know you just said you're not like a method actor. Have like a theoretical thought on, like, I'm not one for like knowing much about Stanislavski and Brecht and, you know, Meisner and all those people. Obviously I've heard about them and read a little bit about them, but is there any of that kind of like theoretical stuff that maybe you would have learned or picked up from a drama school thing that you are using? I mean, have you found that in your path through kind of doing shows and stuff that you're using some of that stuff, or is much of what you're doing kind of learned from watching and learned from your own like personal experiences to the responses of audiences and directors?
A lot of it is obviously, learned through watching and sort of what I perceive as good, trying to do the same. Certainly on the verse delivery side, that's much easier. Is that that's obvious to the ear what is pleasing in terms of how a line is delivered or how it can be delivered clearly and beautifully and interestingly. If it's more sort of kitchen sink drama, then that's different, because then then it is the sort of raw emotion side. And I probably am, I mean, I only got a sketchy familiarity with Stanislavski and so on, but what I've just described probably is, would be considered that end of the method is, you know, I think it's easy to call it emotion memory. You know, you are, yeah, replicating the real raw emotion that's happening to their character at the time.
Yeah.
But it's only if it suits the overall feel of the show. If you're going for this naturalistic show, you want to move people in that way.
Yeah.
Then, you know, that can really work. If you're just there to make them laugh, then, you know, sometimes
a bit more clowning might be.
Yeah, exactly. Doing it naturalistically is just maybe not appropriate. And yeah, the advantage of, like you say, meeting lots of people and working with lots of people is you pick up little tricks here and there, not necessarily a consistent theory, but I like that. That works for me. I'll try that.
Yeah. And how are you, again, so if just to round off that kind of characterization stuff and the rehearsal process, how are you, I could make a very generic question, I suppose, that might draw some interesting stuff out, but how are you creating what you perceive to be a good character? Like, what in your head gets you to a point in the rehearsal where you're like, yeah, I'm ready for the stage? When is there a moment where you're like, I'm here? Or is that just through the whole process of getting everything shaped together that you've, all the stuff we just discussed in terms of how you create the character and how you're shaping it and how the interactions between the other characters are taking place, you're just hoping naturally over the period of the rehearsals you would have reached it by the point your first preview or something? Or are you more kind of rigid in saying, I know what is a good character, I know what, you know, I'm presenting to be a good character, and I'm not there yet? Is there kind of, do you get that or not?
Yeah, for me, I don't like to overdo it, mm-hmm. but rehearsal wise, I like, you know, I like to get out of it, because that's the fun bit. And actually, you learn more on the first performance than, you know, the rehearsals. It is partly the audience reaction, but it's just the feel of the place. You know, you get a sense of it. I mean, with comedies, it's obvious that people are going to laugh at certain points, but obviously you should. Yeah, they might laugh at different nights and different things, so you can never quite predict how the timing's going to go. So don't despair if things don't come off on the first night. But even with a serious play, you do get feel,
yeah,
where it's working or where the pace has dropped and where you need to sort of pick it up a bit, hold the tension a bit in certain parts.
I mean, it's interesting, we fed me nicely into just a quick chat about the shows, and that you're saying like that first night. I mean, I've always been very conscious that the first three or four performances, I watched the actors suddenly realize that there's something here is going quite well, or the opposite, you know, or we missed that, or something's wrong here. But they've got this, you know, you see it just click. You're like, three nights in, they're suddenly like, oh yeah, that worked. We could do this. We can push that. I'm just interested in your thought. Like you're saying, from the first night, you're already like, are you changing stuff, or are you just like, you're just manipulating little bits to get the frissons of like a response out of the audience?
Oh yeah, tiny things, really. Yeah,
right.
You should hopefully not have to change anything drastic by that point. I think it's just impatience. I don't like the idea of it going stale.
Yeah,
and you can lose motivation if it feels too repetitive and you're just doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
In front of an audience, is different. Is that you can get yourself motivated for each individual show, because even if it is a bit repetitive, you've done the same show 24 nights in a row, which I have done. I can't even
imagine like the pain of that. I look at some of these West End guys who've done like the Lion King for 6 years on that.
Yeah. With that, you just got to take pleasure in being in the moment in night after night. But if you do too many rehearsals, that can start to grind you down, I think.
Right.
For me, it can.
Okay.
As an actor, I do get a bit frustrated, I think people are going a bit, you know, are holding the process up, being a bit sort of slow to get things or not learning the words. Yeah.
Yeah. No, again, going back to it, it makes sense, especially if you're, yeah. What are your, is there anything you can like say about the little things that people might come across, like nerves, performing in front of a live audience and stuff like that, when the show comes around, how you would approach that? Like, is there, are you doing specific stuff before you head out on stage? Is, you know, do you feel like a warm-up is important, or do you feel like?
I think your audiences are generally on your side. Certainly this year, they were so excited just to be seeing anything at all.
Yeah, definitely.
They knew whatever you did, it was going to go down well. But even when you feel like they might have high expectations, or I suppose the most nervous you get is, you know, the press are in, you know, that there's right. Someone reviewing. Maybe you might, because I don't like to get a bad write-up. That does get me down. I think it's just, yeah, classic things, you know, take a deep breath, you know, control your breathing, because your breathing is important when you're acting.
Yeah.
But you've got to have control of that. I mean, warm-up wise, really, that is just, yeah, to make sure you can move as freely as you should be able to move, and that your voice is, you know, as audible as it should be, you know, and you've got all the notes there ready. I'd tell you one thing that probably has helped is, you know, because having done so much outdoor,
yeah,
you are used to seeing the faces of individuals right in front of you.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, of course. I never think about that either. It's one weird thing that actors have got to take into account, that you're going to see someone who's not smiling and someone who's not laughing, and oh God, I can't even imagine the pain.
Empty seats.
Yeah.
Seats that weren't empty in the first.
Seats that weren't empty that are now empty. Shit. And what? Yeah. So, what's the advice around dealing with that? Is that just be aware that you're going to see that, or just like?
Yeah, it takes some getting used to, but you really got to maintain focus, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah, you'll see people you know. You'll see people you didn't realize were coming that night that you've not seen for 10 years. You know. You can't let it throw you.
Yeah.
Whereas performing in the Oxford Playhouse, it's just a mass of darkness.
You can't
see anybody. Yeah. And in a way that's much easier. It's just the sort of
out into the void, right? You're just sending it out there. Yeah. No, it's interesting. Like I say, it's another one of those things that when you mention it just gives me, oh God, it just hurts me just to think.
Yeah. I've with these people.
Mental, just absolutely crazy. Can't even, contemplate. Okay, cool. So basically, I'd really like just to go back quickly and talk about like drama school and your acquisition of knowledge. So what you're kind of like over the years of doing stuff, where have you learned most of the stuff that you've your toolbox of tricks and stuff that you use? How have you got it? What's the kind of like, what would you, yeah, where would you direct people or not? Or is it just about experience and doing it? Or,
I mean, by all means, it's worth doing a workshop or a course or picking up a book and so on. But whichever of those you do, it can be hit and miss. You know, you can,
mm-hmm.
you can sort of be misled sometimes. I think, and put too much emphasis on one technique over another sometimes.
Right.
You can only really find what works for you by trying things. And like we said, it is, I have done that sort of magpie thing over the years of, observing, but also talking to, having conversations like this, I suppose.
Yeah.
Where somebody describes how they do something and you think, oh, well, maybe I will give that a try. Listening to directors, definitely. Where they have something constructively critical to say, and, you know, it is important to listen. When, like the Shuffling Feet thing, another director pointed out that sort of a lot of tension in the jaw, which is true. That's sort of family traits. We all have that. And it does tend to freeze up. And, it means I'm not speaking as clearly, or it can restrict the range of expressions I can do with my face.
Yeah.
So it was good that she picked up on that and felt that she could say it.
Yeah. Is there a requirement? No, that's the wrong word. Like, you clearly haven't left or lost out on anything by not having spent 3 years in a room with some people pretending to be a duck. But, and that's me really like demeaning drama school, which is unfair, because, like, and again, I've had just had a conversation with someone who went through drama school, little stuff, and there's clearly a lot more to it than what I'm stupidly saying there. But
I know there are certain risks with it, is that sometimes the techniques that you learn can kind of obscure some of the stuff that's happening naturally.
Right.
Get too hung up on a particular technique.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably quite harmful. And the best drama schools will give you won't let that happen. You know, they'll give you a fully rounded, experience. I mean, it's kind of circular process though, because the best drama schools pick the best, most naturally talented people already. So it's hard to tell whether they're doing a good job or not. But I think, from the amateur's point of view, or like our level, non-professional, is that I wouldn't get too distracted by really fine detail techniques if people can't do the basics right. You know, you need to work on absolute basics, like voice projection. You know, they need to hear what you're saying. There's no point, you know, agonizing over your motivation if nobody hears anything you say.
Which is it's a really, like, a very prevalent one.
Uh-huh.
Like, it comes up a lot when you're like, we've done all this work, no one can hear what you're saying.
Yeah,
like, we didn't think about that. We should have approached that. We should have attacked that much earlier on to try and develop that skill in you, because.
But that's not, again, it's sort of something that you can't fix in 3 months necessarily. If someone
maybe you're right.
Kind of a lifetime of practice.
Yeah, maybe.
But you can bring them on at that stage further. One thing we often come up against is sort of directors have sort of grand ambition to teach the group something brand new that they've never done before. You know, I mean, like, we did flamenco dancing for one shot. It was like, well, we will have to learn this from scratch. So obviously, we're not
it's never going to be,
professional result, really. Whereas with, you know, I've done public speaking a lot. So over time, I've gradually got fairly good at that.
Yeah. So just to maybe try and grab a few, is if we're saying, like, what projection, so if people should be working on that, even if they're not doing a show or whatever, they should be considering, like, that as a tool in their tool bag.
Yeah.
Is there anything else, like, that specifically jumps out at you that might be a kind of a...
Well, relatedly, diction as well. You know, that's important. The stuff I've learned with movement, you know, you could go to dance classes. That will help learn dance. One very specific thing, of course, is stage combat, and that was really valuable to learn that in a workshop environment, and learn from people who have done it and who have real skills in that.
Yeah,
because it's quite a specific technique, isn't it? So
yeah, it's so close to dangerous if you're not.
Yeah,
if you don't know what you're doing, you're always on the edge of stabbing someone in the face.
Great thing to have in a show is some choreographed action like that. So it is a great thing to have done.
Yeah. And what was what's your view on kind of like being immersed in theatre? If you're going to do theatre, like you mentioned reading plays kind of like right at the top, you feel like that's necessary, like just to get a wider breadth of understanding and stuff?
For people wanting to improve, yeah, I definitely go out and see stuff. See, and probably something I don't do enough, which is like challenge myself to see something different.
Right. Yeah.
I do have a habit to see the same old Shakespeare plays over and over again. And, you know, I mean, I work with sort of actors much younger than me who have memberships with like the Royal Court Theatre and things like that. And they were watching things every week because they have, you know, cheaper tickets and stuff. So that put me to shame.
But they get like half price tickets and stuff. Yeah. You can't fight that, can you? It's like, okay, brilliant. I mean, I think loads of good stuff in that. Super useful, like loads of amazing like pointers. It's great to hear, like you, I think those people listening, like clearly you are a really good actor, and it's nice to hear like nothing, and this is like, it's weird for me to say it, nothing that has gone on through your life isn't something that someone else could pick up and do with it. We didn't talk about natural talent. Like clearly there is a thing about natural talent that it does exist. I think like there is if you've got that thing, it's really helpful. You know, that little nugget inside you that allows other stuff to come out. But none of what you've said seems like it's so obscure or difficult to attain that someone couldn't like go out and you know, that thing with confidence, that thing with like, you know, being aware of in the moment of the character's responses and interactions. Mm-hmm. Like that's stuff you can do, right? It's quite esoteric, but you can still do it. It's not unattainable to find yourself getting better, which I think is it's really good, like really good points.
And another thing that occurs to me is sort of the value of watching yourself back.
Oh, really?
Listening to yourself. Yeah, seeing yourself on film, you just think, oh, you know, oh, that's all wrong. And my shoulders are all slumped.
And, oh, you know, man.
And
would you like that as a, is that a good thing for a director to do? Like film a couple of rehearsals, you reckon?
I would love to give that a try sometime, yeah.
Yeah.
Latter stages of rehearsal process. And then, yeah, you're picking up on things that don't look right to you, you know. I've been given sort of DVDs of shows that we've been in, and obviously it's too late to fix anything by then, but you sort of regret, oh, if only I'd...
Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I've always been dubious of doing that just because I don't want to scare people off. I don't want people to look at it and go, oh, no, I'm doing that really badly. There's no way I can, you know, maybe if you know that the people, the way they take it would help with assist them. Mm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, to be fair, it's difficult. It's definitely difficult to watch yourself, I'd say, doing a performance. But, definitely beneficial. Like, you're getting my view of it, as in me, the director. Mm-hmm. And that's massive. Like, that's really massive. Because I do a little trick where I get other people to do their parts.
Mm.
And it's really, I mean, not like loads of stuff, whatever. Just like if there's a difficult moment that feels like it's not clicking, if someone can step out, watch three people interact in the role of their doing, that naturally gives them a different perspective on it. So maybe filming is a tool that I've underutilized. So that's quite a good, yeah, it's interesting. It's going to scare some people now.
Yeah, you could lose hours and hours in the film room. Like,
yeah, literally, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'll have my chalkboard, my little whiteboard with my circles and my crosses, and have my video.